And now, A Colder War, narrated by Paul Hecht.
Analyst. Roger Jorgensen tilts back in his chair reading. He's a fair-haired man in his mid-30s, hair razor-cropped, skin pallid from too much time spent under artificial lights, spectacles, short-sleeved white shirt and tie, photographic ID badge on a chain round his neck. He works in an air-conditioned office with no windows. The file he is reading frightens him. Once, when Roger was a young boy, his father took him to an open day at Nellis Air Force Base out in the California desert. Sunlight glared brilliantly from the polished silver plate flanks of the big bombers sitting in their concrete-lined dispersal bays behind barriers and blinking radiation monitors. The brightly colored streamers flying from their pitot tubes lent them a strange, almost festive appearance. But they were sleeping nightmares. Once awakened, nobody except the flight crew could come within a mile of the nuclear-powered bombers and live. Looking at the gleaming, bulging pods slung onto their wingtip pylons, Roger had a premature inkling of the fires that waited within, a frigid terror that echoed the siren wail of the air raid warnings. He'd sucked nervously on his ice cream and gripped his father's hand tightly while the band ripped through a cheerful Sousa march, and only forgot his fear when a flock of thunder chiefs sliced by overhead and rattled the car windows for miles around. He has the same feeling now, as an adult, reading this intelligence assessment, that he had as a child watching the nuclear-powered bombers sleeping in their concrete beds. There's a blurry photograph of a concrete box inside the file, snapped from above by a high-flying U-2 during the autumn of 61. Three coffin-shaped lakes, bulking dark and gloomy beneath the Arctic sun. A canal heading west, deep in the Soviet heartland, surrounded by warning trefoils and armed guards. Deep waters saturated with calcium salts. Concrete cofferdams lined with gold and lead. A sleeping giant pointed at NATO, more terrifying than any nuclear weapon. Project Cachet. Red Square Redux. Warning. The following briefing film is classified Secret Gold July Boojum. If you do not have Secret Gold July Boojum clearance, leave the auditorium now and report to your unit security officer for debriefing. Failing to observe this notice is an imprisonable offense. You have 60 seconds to comply. Video clip. Red Square in springtime. The sky overhead is clear and blue. There's a little wispy cirrus at high altitude. It forms a brilliant backdrop for flight after flight of four-engined bombers that thunder across the horizon and drop behind the Kremlin's high walls. Voiceover. Red Square, the May Day Parade, 1962. This is the first time that the Soviet Union has publicly displayed weapons classified Gold July Boojum. Here they are. Video clip. Later in the same day, a seemingly endless stream of armor and soldiers marches across the square, turning the air gray with diesel fumes. The trucks roll in line, eight abreast, with soldiers sitting erect in the back. Behind them rumble a battalion of T-56s, their commanders standing at attention and their cupolas saluting the stand. Jets race low and loud overhead, squadrons of MiG-17 fighters. Behind the tanks sprawl a formation of four low-loaders, huge tractors towing low-slung trailers, their load beds strapped down under olive drab tarpaulins. Whatever is under them is uneven, a bit like a loaf of bread the size of a small house. The trucks have an escort of jeep-like vehicles on each side, armed soldiers sitting at attention in their backs. There are big five-pointed symbols painted in silver on each tarpaulin like pentacles. Each star is surrounded by a stylized silver circle, a unit insignia perhaps, but not in the standard format for Red Army units. There's lettering around the circles in a strangely stylized script. Voiceover. These are live servitors under transient control. The vehicles towing them bear the insignia of the 2nd Guards Engineering Brigade, a penal construction unit based in Bukhara and used for structural engineering assignments relating to nuclear installations in the Ukraine and Azerbaijan. This is the first time that any Dresden Agreement party openly demonstrated ownership of this technology. In this instance, the conclusion we are intended to draw is that the 67th Guard Engineering Brigade operates 4 units. Given existing figures for the Soviet Orbat, we can then extrapolate a total task strength of 288 servitors, if this unit is representative. Video clip. 5 huge Tu-95 Bear bombers thunder across the Moscow skies. Voiceover. This conclusion is questionable. For example, in 1964, a total of 240 Bear bomber passes were made over the reviewing stand in front of the Lenin Mausoleum. However, at that time, technical reconnaissance assets verified that the Soviet Air Force has hard stand parking for only 160 of these aircraft, and estimates of airframe production based on photographs of the extent of the Tupolev Design Bureau's works indicate that total production to that date was between 60 and 180 bombers. Further analysis of photographic evidence from the 1964 parade suggests that a single group of 20 aircraft in 4 formations of 5 made repeated passes through the same airspace, the main arc of their circuit lying outside visual observation range of Moscow. This gave rise to the erroneous capacity report of 1964, in which the first strike delivery capability of the Soviet Union was overestimated by as much as 300%. We must therefore take anything that they show us in Red Square with a pinch of salt when preparing force estimates. Quite possibly, these 4 servitors are all they've got. Then again, the actual battalion strength may be considerably higher. Still photographic sequence. From very high altitude, possibly in orbit, an eagle's eye view of a remote village in mountainous country. Mud brick houses huddle together beneath a craggy outcrop. Goats graze nearby. In the second photograph, something has rolled through the village, leaving a trail of devastation. The path is quite unlike the trail of damage left by an artillery bombardment. Something roughly 4 meters wide has shaved the rocky plateau smooth, wearing it down as if with a terrible heat. A corner of a shack leans drunkenly, the other half sliced away cleanly. White bones gleam faintly in the track. No vultures descend to stab at the remains. Voiceover. These images were taken very recently on successive orbital passes of a KH-11 satellite. They were timed precisely 89 minutes apart. This village was the home of a noted Mujahideen leader. Note the similar footprint to the payloads on the load beds of the trucks seen at the 1962 parade. These indicators were present, denoting the presence of servitor units in use by Soviet forces in Afghanistan, the 4-meter-wide gauge of the assimilation track, the total molecular breakdown of organic matter in the track, the speed of destruction. The event took less than 5,000 seconds to completion. No survivors were visible, and the causative agent had already been uplifted by the time of the 2nd orbital pass. This, despite the residents of the community being armed with DSHK heavy machine guns, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and AK-47s. Lastly, there is no sign of the causative agent even deviating from its course, but the entire area is depopulated. Except for excarnated residue, there is no sign of human habitation. In the presence of such unique indicators, We have no alternative but to conclude that the Soviet Union has violated the Dresden Agreement by deploying Gold July Bujum in a combat mode in the Khyber Pass. There are no grounds to believe that a NATO armored division would have fared any better than these Mujahideen without nuclear support. Puzzle Palace. Roger isn't a soldier. He's not much of a patriot either. He signed up with the CIA after college, in the aftermath of the Church Commission hearings in the early 70s. The company was out of the assassination business, just a bureaucratic engine rolling out national security assessments. That's fine by Roger. Only now, 5 years later, he's no longer able to roll along, casually disengaged like a car in neutral, bowling down a shallow incline toward his retirement, pension, and a gold watch. He puts the file down on his desk, and with a shaking hand pulls an illicit cigarette from the pack he keeps in his drawer. He lights it and leans back for a moment to draw breath, force relaxation, staring at smoke rolling in the air beneath the merciless light until his hand stops shaking. Most people think spies are afraid of guns or KGB guards or barbed wire, but in point of fact, the most dangerous thing they face is paper. Papers carry secrets. Papers carry death warrants. Papers like this one. This folio, with its blurry 18-year-old faked missile photographs and estimates of time survivor curves and pervasive psychosis ratios, can give you nightmares, dragging you awake screaming in the middle of the night. It's one of a series of highly classified pieces of paper that he is summarizing for the eyes of the National Security Council and the President-elect, if his head of department and the DDCIA approve it. And here he is, having to calm his nerves with a cigarette before he turns the next page. After a few minutes, Roger's hand is still. He leaves his cigarette in the eagle-headed ashtray and picks up the intelligence report again. It's a summary, itself the distillation of thousands of pages and hundreds of photographs. It's barely 20 pages long. As of 1963, its date of preparation, the CIA knew very little about Project Cachet, just the bare skeleton and rumors from a highly placed spy, and their own equivalent project, of course. Lacking the Soviet lead in that particular field, the USAF fielded the silver-plate white elephants of the NB-39 project. 12 atomic-powered bombers armed with XK Pluto, ready to tackle Project Cachet should the Soviets show signs of unsealing the bunker. 300 megatons of H-bombs pointed at a single target, and nobody was certain it would be enough to do the job. And then there was the hard-to-conceal fiasco in Antarctica. Egg on Face, a subterranean nuclear test program in international territory. If nothing else, it had been enough to stop JFK running for a second term. The test program was a bad excuse, but it was far better than confessing what had really happened to the 501st Airborne Division on the cold plateau beyond Mount Erebus. The plateau that the public didn't know about, that didn't show up on the maps issued by the Geological Survey departments of those governments party to the Dresden Agreement of 1931, an arrangement that even Hitler had stuck to. The plateau that had swallowed more U-2 spy planes than the Soviet Union, more surface expeditions than darkest Africa. Shit. How the hell am I going to put this together for him? Rogers spent the past 5 hours staring at this 20-page report, trying to think of a way of summarizing their dryly quantifiable terror in words that will give the reader power over them, the power to think the unthinkable. But it's proving difficult. The new man in the White House is straight-talking, demands straight answers. He's pious enough not to believe in the supernatural, confident enough that just listening to one of his speeches is an uplifting experience, if you can close your eyes and believe in mourning in America. There's probably no way of explaining Project Cachet, or XK Pluto, or MK Nightmare, or the Gates, without watering them down into just another weapon system, which they are not. Weapons may have deadly or hideous effects, but they acquire moral character from the actions of those who use them. Whereas these projects are indelibly stained by a patina of ancient evil. He hopes that if the balloon ever does go up, if the sirens wail, he and Andrea and Jason will be left behind to face the nuclear fire. It'll be a merciful death compared with what he suspects lurks out there in the unexplored vastness beyond the gates, the vastness that made Nixon cancel the manned space program, leaving just the standing joke of a white elephant shuttle, when he realized just how hideously dangerous the space race might become, the darkness that broke Jimmy Carter's faith and turned Lyndon B. Johnson into an alcoholic. He stands up, nervously shifts from one foot to the other, looks round at the walls of his cubicle. For a moment, the cigarette, smoldering on the edge of his ashtray, catches his attention. Wisps of blue-gray smoke coil like lazy dragons in the air above it, writhing in a strange cuneiform text. He blinks, and they're gone, and the skin on the small of his back prickles as if someone had pissed on his grave. Shit. Finally, a spoken word in the silence. His hand is shaking as he stubs the cigarette out. Mustn't let this get to me. He glances at the wall. It's 1900 hours. Too late. Too late. He should go home. Andy will be worrying herself sick. In the end, it's all too much. He slides the thin folder into the safe behind his chair, turns the locking handle, and spins the dial, then signs himself out of the reading room and goes through the usual exit search. During the 30-mile drive home, he spits out of the window, trying to rid his mouth of the taste of Auschwitz ashes. Late night in the White House. The colonel is febrile, jittering about the room with gung-ho enthusiasm. "That was a mighty fine report you pulled together, Jurgensen." He paces over to the niche between the office filing cabinet and the wall, turns on the spot, paces back to the far side of his desk. "You understand the fundamentals. I like that. A few more guys like you running the company, and we wouldn't have this fuck-up in Tehran." He grins, contagiously. The colonel is a firestorm of enthusiasm, burning out of control like a 40s comic book hero. He has Roger on the edge of his chair, almost sitting at attention. Roger has to bite his tongue to remind himself not to call the colonel sir. He's a civilian, not in the chain of command. "That's why I've asked Deputy Director McMurdo to reassign you to this office to work on my team as company liaison, and I'm pleased to say that he's agreed." Roger can't stop himself. "To work here, sir?" Here is in the basement of the executive office building, an extension hanging off the White House. Whoever the colonel is, he's got pull in positively magical quantities. "What will I be doing, sir? You said your team..." "Relax a bit. Drink your coffee." The colonel paces back behind his desk, sits down. Roger sips cautiously at the brown sludge in the mug with the Marine Corps crest. "The president told me to organize a team," says the colonel so casually that Roger nearly chokes on his coffee, "to handle contingencies, October surprises. Those asshole commies down in Nicaragua, we're eyeball to eyeball with an evil empire, Ozzy, and we can't afford to blink. Those were his exact words. The evil empire uses dirty tricks, but nowadays we're better than they are. Bunch of hicks, like some third-world dictatorship, upper volta with Shoggoths. My job is to pin 'em down and cut 'em up. Don't give 'em a chance to whack the shoe on the UN table. Demand concessions. If they want to bluff, I'll call 'em on it. If they want to go toe-to-toe, I'll dance with 'em. He's up and pacing again. The company used to do that and do it okay back in the 50s and 60s, but too many bleeding hearts. It makes me sick. If you guys went back to wet ops today, you'd have journalists following you every time you went to the John in case it was newsworthy. Well, we aren't going to do it that way this time. It's a small team, and the buck stops here. The colonel pauses, then glances at the ceiling. Well, maybe up there. But you get the picture. I need someone who knows the company, an insider who has clearance up the wazoo, who can go in and get the dope before it goes through a fucking committee of ass-watching bureaucrats. I'm also getting someone from the Puzzle Palace and some words to give me pull with Big Black. He glances at Roger sharply, and Roger nods. He's cleared for National Security Agency, Puzzle Palace, Intelligence, and knows about Big Black, the National Reconnaissance Office, which is so secret that even its existence is still classified. Roger is impressed by this colonel, despite his better judgment. Within the Byzantine world of the U.S. intelligence services, he is talking about building his very own pocket battleship and sailing it under the Jolly Roger with letters of marque and reprise signed by the president. But Roger still has some questions to ask, to scope out the limits of what Colonel North is capable of. What about fever dream, sir? The colonel puts his coffee cup down. I own it, he says bluntly. And Nightmare, and Pluto. Any means necessary, he said, and I have an executive order with the ink still damp to prove it. Those projects aren't part of the national command structure anymore. Officially, they've been stood down from active status and are being considered for inclusion in the next round of arms reduction talks. They're not part of the deterrent orbat anymore. We're standardizing on just nuclear weapons. Unofficially, they're part of my group, and I will use them as necessary to contain and reduce the evil empire's war-making abilities. Roger's skin crawls with an echo of that childhood terror. And the Dresden Agreement? Don't worry. Nothing short of them breaking it would lead me to do so. The colonel grins toothily. Which is where you come in. The Moonlit Shores of Lake Vostok. The metal pier is dry and cold, the temperature hovering close to 0 degrees Fahrenheit. It's oppressively dark in the cavern under the ice, and Roger shivers inside his multiple layers of insulation, shifts from foot to keep warm. He has to swallow to keep his ears clear, and he feels slightly dizzy from the pressure in the artificial bubble of air pumped under the icy ceiling to allow humans to exist here under the Ross ice shelf. They'll all spend more than a day sitting in depressurization chambers on the way back up to the surface. There's no sound from the waters lapping just below the edge of the pier. The floodlights vanish into the surface and keep going. The water in the subsurface Antarctic lake is incredibly clear, but has swallowed up rapidly, giving an impression of infinite inky depths. Manfred is here as the colonel's representative to observe the arrival of the probe, receive the consignment that they're carrying, and report back that everything is running smoothly. The others try to ignore him, jittery at the presence of the man from D.C. There are a gaggle of engineers and artificers flown out via McMurdo Base to handle the midget sub's operations. A nervous lieutenant supervises a squad of Marines with complicated-looking weapons, half-gun and half-video camera, stationed at the corners of the raft. And there's the usual platform crew, deep-sea rig maintenance types, but subdued and nervous-looking. They're afloat in a bubble of pressurized air, wedged against the underside of the Antarctic ice sheet, Below them stretched the still, supercooled waters of Lake Vostok. They're waiting for a rendezvous. 500 yards, reports one of the techs. Rising on 10. His companion nods. They're waiting for the men in the midget sub, drilling quietly through 3 miles of frigid water, intruders in a long-drowned tomb. Have them back on board in no time. The sub has been away for nearly a day. It set out with enough battery juice for the journey and enough air to keep the crew breathing for a long time if there's a system failure. But they've learned the hard way that fail-safe systems aren't. Not out here, at the edge of the human world. Roger shuffles some more.
I was afraid the battery load on that cell you replaced would trip an under-voltage isolator and we'd be here till hell freezes over,
the sub-driver jokes to his neighbor.
Looking round, Roger sees one of the Marines cross himself.
Have you heard anything from Gorman or Seslowitz? He asks quietly. The lieutenant checks his clipboard.
Not since departure, sir, he says. We don't have comms with the sub while it's submerged, too small for ELF, and we don't want to alert anybody who might be, listening.
Indeed. The yellow hunchback shape of the midget submarine appears at the edge of the radiance shed by the floodlights. Surface waters undulate, oily, as the sub rises.
Crew transfer vehicle sighted, the driver mutters into his mic.
He's suddenly very busy adjusting trim settings, blowing bottled air into ballast tanks, discussing ullage levels and blade count with his number two. The crane crew is busy too, running their long boom out over the lake. The sub's hatch is visible now, bobbing along the top of the water. The lieutenant is suddenly active.
Jones, Savatty, stake it out, left and center.
The crane is already swinging the huge lifting hook over the sub, waiting to bring it aboard.
I want eyeballs on the portholes before you crack this thing.
It's the 10th run, 7th manned, through the eye of the needle on the lake bed, the drowned structure so like an ancient temple, and Roger has a bad feeling about it. We can't get away with this forever, he reasons. Sooner or later. The sub comes out of the water like a gigantic yellow bath toy, a cyborg whale designed by a god with a sense of humor. It takes tense minutes to winch it in and maneuver it safely onto the platform. Marines take up position, shining torches in through two of the portholes that bulge myopically from the smooth curve of the sub's nose. Up on top, someone is talking into a handset, plugged into the stubby conning tower. The hatch, locking wheel, begins to turn.
Gorman, sir.
It's the lieutenant. In the light of the sodium floods, everything looks sallow and washed out. The soldier's face is the color of damp cardboard, slack with relief. Roger waits while the submariner, Gorman, clambers unsteadily down from the top deck. He's a tall, emaciated-looking man, wearing a red thermal suit 3 sizes too big for him. Salt-and-pepper stubble textures his jaw with sandpaper. Right now, he looks like a cholera victim, sallow skin. Smell of acrid ketones as his body eats its own protein reserves. A more revolting miasma hovering over him. There's a slim aluminum briefcase chained to his left wrist, a bracelet of bruises darkening the skin above it. Roger steps forward.
Sir?
Gorman straightens up for a moment, almost a shadow of military attention. He's unable to sustain it.
We made the pickup. Here's the QA sample. The rest is down below. You have the unlocking code? He asks wearily.
Jurgensen nods. 158-12-29. Gorman slowly dials it into a combination lock on the briefcase, lets it fall open and unthreads the chain from his wrist. Floodlights glisten on polythene bags stuffed with white powder, 5 kilos of high-grade heroin from the hills of Afghanistan.
There's another quarter of a ton packed in boxes in the crew compartment. The lieutenant inspects it, closes the case, and passes it to Jorgensen.
Delivery successful, sir.
From the ruins on the high plateau of the Taklamakan Desert to American territory in Antarctica by way of a detour through gates linking alien worlds. Gates that nobody knows how to create or destroy except the predecessors, and they aren't talking.
What's it like through there? Roger demands, shoulders tense. What did you see?
Up on top, Seslowitz is sitting on the sub's hatch, half slumping against the crane's attachment post. There's obviously something very wrong with him.
Gorman shakes his head and looks away. The wan light makes the razor-sharp creases on his face stand out, like the crackled and shattered surface of a Jovian moon. Crow's feet, wrinkles, signs of age, hair the color of moonlight.
It took so long, he says, almost complaining, sinks to his knees. All that time, we've been gone.
He leans against the side of the sub, a pale shadow, aged beyond his years.
The sun was so bright, and our radiation detectors. Must have been a solar flare or something.
He doubles over and retches at the edge of the platform.
Roger looks at him for a long, thoughtful minute.
Gorman is 25 and a fixer for Big Black, early history in the Green Berets. He was in rude good health 2 days ago when he set off through the gate to make the pickup.
Roger glances at the lieutenant.
I'd better go and tell the colonel, he says.
A pause.
Get these two back to recovery and see they're looked after. I don't expect we'll be sending any more crews through Victor Tango for a while.
He turns and walks toward the lift shaft, hands clasped behind his back to keep them from shaking.
Behind him, alien moonlight glimmers across the floor of Lake Vostok, 3 miles, and untold light-years from home.
General LeMay would be proud.
Warning. The following briefing film is classified Secret Indigo March Snipe. If you do not have Secret Indigo March Snipe clearance, leave the auditorium now and report to your unit security officer for debriefing. Failing to observe this notice is an imprisonable offense. You have 60 seconds to comply.
Video clip. Shot of huge bomber, rounded gun turrets sprouting like mushrooms from the decaying log of its fuselage, weirdly bulbous engine pods slung too far out toward each wingtip, 4 turbine tubes clumped around each atomic kernel.
Voiceover.
The Convair B-39 Peacemaker is the most formidable weapon in our Strategic Air Command's arsenal for peace. Powered by 8 nuclear-heated Pratt & Whitney NP-4051 turbojets, it circles endlessly above the Arctic ice cap, waiting for the call. This is Item 1, the flight training and test bird. 12 other birds await criticality on the ground. For once launched, a B-39 can only be landed at 2 airfields in Alaska that are equipped to handle them. This one's been airborne for 9 months so far and shows no signs of age.
Cut to.
A shark, the size of a Boeing 727, falls away from the open bomb bay of the monster. Stubby delta wings slice through the air, propelled by a rocket-bright glare.
Voiceover.
A modified Navajo missile, test article for an XK Pluto payload, dives away from a carrier plane. Unlike the real thing, this one carries no hydrogen bombs, no direct cycle fission ramjet to bring retaliatory destruction to the enemy. Traveling at Mach 3, the XK Pluto will overfly enemy territory, dropping megaton range bombs until, its payload exhausted, it seeks out and circles a final target. Once over the target, it will eject its reactor core and rain molten plutonium on the heads of the enemy. XK Pluto is a total weapon. every aspect of its design, from the shock wave it creates as it hurtles along at treetop height to the structure of its atomic reactor is designed to inflict damage. Cut to Belsen postcards, Auschwitz movies, A Holiday in Hell. Voiceover. This is why we need such a weapon. This is what it deters. The abominations first raised by the Third Reich's organization Tolt, now removed to the Ukraine and deployed in the service of New Soviet Man, as our enemy calls himself. Cut to a sinister gray concrete slab, the upper surface of a Mayan step pyramid built with East German cement, barbed wire, guns. A drained canal slashes north from the base of the pyramid toward the Baltic coastline, relic of the installation process. This is where it came from. The slave barracks squat beside the pyramid like a horrible memorial to its black uniformed builders. Cut to the new resting place. A big concrete monolith surrounded by three concrete-lined lakes and a canal. It sits in the midst of a Ukraine landscape, flat as a pancake, stretching out forever in all directions. Voiceover. This is Project Cachet, the Kremlin's key to the gates of hell. Technology Taster. We know they first came here during the Precambrian Age. Professor Gould is busy with his view graphs, eyes down, trying not to pay too much attention to his audience. We have samples of macrofauna discovered by paleontologist Charles D. Walcott on his pioneering expeditions into the Canadian Rockies near the eastern border of British Columbia. A hand drawing of something indescribably weird fetches up on the screen. Like this Opabinia, which died there 640 million years ago. Fossils of soft-bodied animals that old are rare. The Burgess Shale deposits are the best record of the Precambrian fauna anyone has found to date. A skinny woman with big hair and bigger shoulder pads sniffs loudly. She has no truck with these antediluvian dates. Roger winces sympathy for the academic. He'd rather she wasn't here, but somehow she got wind of the famous paleontologist's visit, and she's the colonel's administrative assistant. Telling her to leave would be a career-limiting move. The important item to note, photograph of a mangled piece of rock, visual echoes of the Opabinia, is the tooth marks. We find them also, their exact cognates, on the ring segments of the Z-series specimens returned by the Peabody Antarctic Expedition of 1926. The world of the Precambrian was laid out differently from our own. Most of the land masses that today are separate continents were joined into one huge structure. Indeed, these samples were originally separated by only 2,000 miles or thereabouts, suggesting that they brought their own parasites with them. "What do tooth marks tell us about them that we need to know?" asks the colonel. The doctor looks up, his eyes gleam. "That something liked to eat them when they were fresh." There's a brief rattle of laughter. "Something with jaws that open and close, like the iris in your camera, something we thought was extinct." Another view graph, this time with a blurry underwater photograph on it. The thing looks a bit like a weird fish, a turbocharged armored hagfish with side skirts and spoilers, or maybe a squid with not enough tentacles. The upper head is a flattened disc fronted by two bizarre fern-like tentacles drooping over the weird sucker mouth on its underside. "This snapshot was taken in Lake Vostok last year. It should be dead. There's nothing there for it to eat. This, ladies and gentlemen, is Anomalocaris, our tooth chewer." He pauses for a moment. "I'm very grateful to you for showing it to me," he adds, even though it's going to make a lot of my colleagues very angry.
Is that a shy grin? The professor moves on rapidly, not giving Roger a chance to fathom his real reaction.
Now this is interesting in the extreme, Gould comments.
Whatever it is, it looks like a cauliflower head, or maybe a brain. Fractally branching stalks, continuously diminishing in length and diameter, until they turn into an iridescent fuzzy manifold wrapped around a central stem. The base of the stem is rooted to a barrel-shaped structure that stands on four stubby tentacles.
We had somehow managed to cram Anomalocaris into our taxonomy, but this is something that has no precedent.
It bears a striking resemblance to an enlarged body segment of Hallucigenia. Here he shows another view graph, something like a stiletto-heeled centipede wearing a war bonnet of tentacles.
But a year ago we worked out that we had poor Hallucigenia upside down, and it was actually just a spiny worm. And the high levels of iridium and diamond in the head here, this isn't a living creature, at least not within the animal kingdom I've been studying for the past 30 years. There's no cellular structure at all. I asked one of my colleagues for help, and they were completely unable to isolate any DNA or RNA from it at all. It's more like a machine that displays biological levels of complexity.
Can you put a date to it? Asks the colonel.
Yep, the professor grins. It predates the wave of atmospheric atomic testing that began in 1945. That's about all. We think it's from sometime in the first half of this century, last half of last century. It's been dead for years, but there are older people still walking this earth. In contrast, he flips to the picture of Anomalocaris, this specimen we found in rocks that are roughly 610 million years old.
He whips up another shot, similar structure, much clearer.
Note how similar it is to the dead but not decomposed one. They're obviously still alive somewhere.
He looks at the colonel, suddenly bashful and tongue-tied. Can I talk about the thing we were like earlier?
Sure, go ahead. Everyone here is cleared for it.
The colonel's casual wave takes in the big-haired secretary, and Roger, and the two guys from Big Black who are taking notes, and the very serious woman from the Secret Service, and even the balding, worried-looking admiral with the double chin and Coke-bottle glasses.
Oh, all right.
Bashfulness falls away.
Well, we've done some preliminary dissections on the Anomalocaris tissues you supplied us with, and we've sent some samples for laboratory analysis. Nothing anyone could deduce much from, he adds hastily. He straightens up.
What we discovered is quite simple. These samples didn't originate in Earth's ecosystem. Cladistic analysis of their intracellular characteristics and what we've been able to work out of their biochemistry indicates not a point of divergence from our own ancestry, but the absence of common ancestry. A cabbage is more human, has more in common with us than that creature.
You can tell by looking at the fossil 600 million years after it died, but live tissue samples are something else.
Item. It's a multicellular organism, but each cell appears to have multiple structures like nuclei, a thing called a syncytium. No DNA. It uses RNA with a couple of base pairs that aren't used by terrestrial biology. We haven't been able to figure out what most of its organelles do, what their terrestrial cognates would be, and it builds proteins using a couple of amino acids that we don't, that nothing does. Either it's descended from an ancestry that diverged from ours before the archaeobacteria, or more probably, it is no relative at all.
He isn't smiling anymore.
The gateways, Colonel? Yeah, that's about the size of it. The critter you've got there was retrieved by one of our, missions on the other side of a gate.
Gould nods.
I don't suppose you could get me some more, he asks hopefully.
All missions are suspended, pending an investigation into an accident we had earlier this year, the colonel says, with a significant glance at Roger. Suslowitz died 2 weeks ago. Gorman is still disastrously sick, connective tissue rotting in his body, massive radiation exposure the probable cause. Normal service will not be resumed. The pipeline will remain empty until someone can figure out a way to make the deliveries without losing the crew. Roger inclines his head minutely.
Oh, well, the professor shrugs. Let me know if you do.
By the way, do you have anything approximating a fix on the other end of the gate?
No, says the colonel, and this time Roger knows he's lying.
Mission 4, before the colonel diverted their payload capacity to another purpose, planted a compact radio telescope in an empty courtyard in the city on the far side of the gate, XK Masada, where the air's too thin to breathe without oxygen, where the sky is indigo and the buildings cast razor-sharp shadows across a rocky plain baked to the consistency of pottery under a blood-red sun. Subsequent analysis of pulsar signals recorded by the station confirmed that it was nearly 600 light-years closer to the galactic core, inward along the same spiral arm. There are glyphs on the alien buildings that resemble symbols seen in grainy black-and-white Minox photos of the doors of the bunker in the Ukraine, symbols behind which the subject of Project Cachet lies undead and sleeping, something evil, scraped from a nest in the drowned wreckage of a city on the Baltic floor.
Why do you want to know where they came from?
Well, we know so little about the context in which life evolves. For a moment, the professor looks wistful.
We have had only one datum point, Earth, this world. Now we have a second, a fragment of a second. If we get a third, we can begin to ask deep questions like, not, is there life out there, because we know the answer to that one now, but questions like, what sort of life is out there, and is there a place for us?
Roger shudders. Idiot, he thinks. If only you knew, you wouldn't be so happy. He restrains the urge to speak up. Doing so would be another career-limiting move. More to the point, it might be a life expectancy-limiting move for the professor, who certainly didn't deserve any such drastic punishment for his cooperation. Besides, Harvard professors visiting the executive office building in D.C. are harder to disappear than comm-simp teachers in some fly-blown jungle village in Nicaragua. Somebody might notice. The colonel would be annoyed. Roger realizes that Professor Gould is staring at him.
Do you have a question for me?
Asks the distinguished paleontologist.
In a moment.
Roger shakes himself. Remembering time survivor curves, the captured Nazi medical atrocity records, mapping the ability of a human brain to survive in close proximity to the Baltic singularity, Mengele's insanity, the SS's final attempt to liquidate the survivors, the witnesses. Cachet primed and pointed at the American heartland like a darkly evil gun. The world-eating mind, adrift in brilliant dreams of madness, estivating in the absence of its prey, dreaming of the minds of sapient beings, be they barrel-bodied, wing-flying, tentacular things, or their human inheritors.
Do you think they could have been intelligent, Professor? Conscious, like us?
I'd say so. Gould's eyes glitter. This one, he points to a view graph, isn't alive as we know it, and this one his fond predecessor, God help him, barrel-bodied and bat-winged, had what looks like a lot of very complex ganglia, not a brain, as we know it, but at least as massive as our own, and some specialized grasping adaptations that might be interpreted as facilitating tool use. Put the two together, and you have a high-level technological civilization. Gateways between planets orbiting different stars. Alien flora, fauna, or whatever. I'd say an interstellar civilization isn't out of the picture, one that has been extinct for deep geological time, 10 times as long as the dinosaurs, but that has left relics that work. His voice is trembling with emotion. We humans, we've barely scratched the surface. The longest lasting of our relics? All our buildings will be dust in 20,000 years, even the pyramids. Neil Armstrong's footprints in the Sea of Tranquility will crumble under micrometeoroid bombardment in a mere 500,000 years or so. The emptied oil fields will refill over 10 million years, methane percolating up through the mantle, continental drift will erase everything. But these people, they built to last. There's so much to learn from them. I wonder if we're worthy pretenders to their technological crown.
I'm sure we are, Professor, the Colonel's secretary says brassily. Isn't that right, Ollie?
The Colonel nods, grinning. You betcha, Fawn. You betcha.